finish off. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, "Let us help you build, because, like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia.
At this point in the reading, we jump forward some hundreds of years to events that occurred in the writer's own lifetime. At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the days of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabiel, and the rest of his associates wrote a letter to Artaxerxes. The letter was written in Aramaic script and in the Aramaic language. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshai, the secretary, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes the king as follows. Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshai, the secretary, together with the rest of their associates, the judges, officials, and administrators over the people from Persia, Uruk, and Babylon, the Elamites of Susa, and the other people whom the great and honorable Ashurbanipal deported and settled in the city of Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates. And this is a copy of the letter they sent him. "To King Artaxerxes, from your servants in Trans-Euphrates, the king should know that the people who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if this city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes, tribute, or duty will be paid, and eventually the royal revenues will suffer. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace, and it's not proper for us to see the king dishonored, we are sending this message to inform the king so that a search may be made in the archives of your predecessors. In these records, you will find that this city is a rebellious city, troublesome to kings and provinces, a place with a long history of sedition. That's why this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is built and its walls are restored, you will be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates." The king sent this reply. "To Rehum, the commanding officer, Shimshai, the secretary, and the rest of their associates living in Samaria and elsewhere in Trans-Euphrates, greetings. The letter you sent us has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order and a search was made, and it was found that this city has a long history of revolt against kings and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates, and taxes, tribute, and duty were paid to them. Now issue an order to these men to stop work so that this city will not be rebuilt until I so order. Be careful not to neglect this matter. Why let this threat grow to the detriment of the royal interests?" As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai the secretary and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. Thus the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia.
Well, please do keep the Bible open at that page. We're going to look at that together. Thank you very much, Tara and Franklin, for reading it for us. We're going to think about it together. I've given it this title, Narrow-Minded About Other Beliefs. Narrow-Minded About Other Beliefs. There's an old joke about this, so old that you've probably heard me tell it several times, but I'm going to tell it again anyway. It originally comes from Emo Phillips. And he tells the story like this. He says, I saw a man about to jump off a bridge, so I went to stop him, and he said, nobody loves me. And I said, well, God loves you. Do you believe in God? And he said, yes. And I said, well, are you Jewish or Christian? He said, Christian. I said, me too. Well, are you Catholic or Protestant? He said, Protestant. I said, me too. Well, what church do you belong to? He said, Baptist. I said, oh, me too. But do you belong to Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist? And he replied, well, Northern Baptist. But do you belong to Northern Liberal Baptist or Northern Conservative Baptist? And he said, Northern Conservative Baptist. But do you belong to Northern Conservative Baptist Council of 1879? Or do you belong to Northern Conservative Baptist Council of 1912? He said, 1879. I said, die, heretic, and pushed him off the bridge. forgive the bad taste in jokes, but I think it sort of works, that joke, because it sounds a little bit too familiar to us. And we recognize that idea of Christians being quick to divide, reluctant to work together, slow to cooperate, fussy about little differences in our history or in our belief system. And it shouldn't be that way, because Jesus draws people together from all over the world, from lots of different cultures and backgrounds, with all sorts of different opinions and histories, and he makes us part of one church, a church that the Bible pictures as a kind of temple that God is building, made up of huge variety. And so we ought to be good at working together. And I want to say that my experience as a minister is that I think Christians are actually not bad at working together. You look at the debates going on in the world, you look at world politics and the conflict there, you look at the wars between different countries, and I want to say that as I meet with other ministers, I find quite a lot of cooperation and working together. Churches from different with different ideas, different beliefs about things that are important, churches with different histories that are part of different networks, and churches that do things on Sundays in very different ways and have different styles, often will pull together and work together to promote the cause of Christianity and to be a team. That's how it should be. And if you look at the influence of Christianity on the history of the Western world, you'll find that it is often Christianity that is saying, let's be more tolerant, let's allow, let's discuss and differ with people, but let's coexist and let's allow these different beliefs and different people to be together. That's how it should be. Often differences between churches might just be differences of which network they happen to belong to and what the history of that network was 100 years or 1,000 years ago. But are there differences that do matter? Are there times when Christians can't just agree to differ and work together anyway? Are there times when that would not please God and when that would be counterproductive to do? Well, our Bible reading in the book of Ezra helps us with that issue. It's a book you might not know very well. We've been reading through it on Sunday mornings and in our small groups, in our home groups, and we've seen that the work of God is pictured for us as building a temple. This is before the time of Jesus. The believers are all gathered together in one city, and they're physically building a temple. And that is God's work of, it's a picture of God's work of renewal and restoration and of reconnecting, of coming back to God and growing in him. And already we've seen in Ezra how God moved people's hearts to get that work started, and how he gathered people for that work together, and how the work did start, and how they've been celebrating and praising God for making a start. But in this chapter, we're going to see some of the obstacles and some of the difficulties this Sunday and next Sunday. And I'm just going to put some of those obstacles from our Bible reading up on the screen. Here's the first one. Opponents offer to help. That's in verses 1 to 3 of chapter 4. Those who are actually not in favour of God's work and who don't really want to see it happen might come across, they might seem as if they're actually supportive and trying to help. So if we turn back again to the beginning of chapter 4 on page 475, I'm going to read first couple of sentences again. Chapter 4, verse 1. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles, those who had been living away from Jerusalem, were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel, he's the leader in Jerusalem, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, let us help you. Let us help you build, because, like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. Now, that sounds really helpful. That sounds really kind of them. How generous and constructive for these people to say, oh, we think you're doing a great thing. We like the same God. We worship the same God. Let us join your team. Let us work with you. They sound like friends and allies, and it would be very rude to turn them away and say no to them. But the writer gives us a clue that they're not what they seem. Do you notice that in chapter 4, verse 1? When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin, these people are actually enemies, they're opponents, they're against this work. And the reaction that they get from the leaders of Jerusalem is a strong reaction. Do you see that in verse 3? But Zerubbabel, Joshua, he's the high priest, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, you have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. It's very blunt, isn't it? Firm and direct. They say, you have no part with us. You're nothing to do with us. We're not partners. We're not a team. And we'll do this alone. Why are they regarded as enemies? Why such a strong reaction against them? Well, the clue is there, if you look a bit closer, at the end of verse 2. In their own words, they admit that they've been sacrificing to God since the time that an old Assyrian king brought them there. Now, it helps to have a bit of history, a bit of background to this, so let me just put it briefly up on the screen. At the end of the Old Testament, there are three great world empires that kind of dominate the whole Middle East. And the first of them was Assyria, and that king is mentioned in the Bible in the reading, Esarhaddon. That was the first exile. That was the first time God's people were taken away from Jerusalem and forced away. And then the next superpower, the next empire, Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, finished off Israel by destroying the temple in Jerusalem. And then finally, the Persian Empire comes in and King Cyrus has kindly allowed them to come back and rebuild their temple. And these people are saying, we were brought to this area by the Assyrian king Esarhaddon. And ever since then, we've been sacrificing to God. Now that would ring two alarm bells. That raises two very big problems. The first is, it means these people were sacrificing to God when there was no temple in existence in Jerusalem. They haven't been using the way that God has provided to be right with God. They think you don't need to do that. They haven't stuck with what it said earlier in the Bible. God has provided a way to be right with him. He's provided sacrifices for the forgiveness of their sins. He's provided a way for them to come to God and reach him. But they have been using some other way, a way that might seem similar, but is actually not the way that God provided to come to him and to reach him. That's the first alarm bell, if they've been sacrificing all that time when there was no temple. The second is they were brought into that area from other places, and that means other places with other religions. They were brought here by the Assyrians, who are not believers, from places where people are not believers, And the leaders of Jerusalem will be thinking back to their history and they'll know what was happening in that time. They'll know it was like this. Here's what it says about those days from 2 Kings 17, verse 33. They worshipped the Lord, but they also served their own gods in accordance with the customs of the nations from which they had been brought. So here are people who are offering to help, but they're actually saying, look, the worship of God, we can mingle it with other religions and with other ways of worship. And the way that God has provided, well, we don't need that. We can have our own way to be right with God. And if you fast forward a few hundred years to Jesus and his death on the cross, you realize why this matters. Because Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me. That's why he dies on the cross for humanity, because it's necessary, because it's needed, because it is the way that we can come into friendship with God and receive his love. If there were other ways to do that, you know, it would be nice to be able to say that. It would be nice to say, well, all religions are equally valid, and it doesn't really matter whether you go on an Islamic pilgrimage or whether you do some Hindu meditation, or it doesn't matter what religious practice you use, it will all get you there. Well, if that were true, then Jesus would not have gone to the trouble of coming into our world and being put to death on the cross. And that's why he said, no one can come to the Father except through me. God loves to offer mercy. He loves to welcome people. He loves to forgive people, whatever their background, whatever their history, whatever their, wherever they're from, whatever their religion. But we do need to receive that mercy through Jesus and through the cross of Christ and through the way that God has provided. And sometimes people might seem very helpful. It might sound quite Christian even. And they might say, let us come and help you in all that you're doing. Let us be part of your team. But they're working towards an entirely different goal. Their aim is not to bring people to Jesus and the cross and to come to God in that way, but to come to God in other ways and to work in other ways. And actually, in many ways, that's a greater danger. Someone who is obviously against Christianity in a very clear way is easy to spot and easy to avoid, but someone who sounds quite Christian and opens the Bible and mentions Jesus and meets in a building that looks like a Christian building or writes a book that is published as a Christian book, well, that is much harder to spot. And because of that, much more dangerous. Jesus had a great picture of this. He talked about wolves in sheep's clothing. It's a great sort of fun kind of cartoony way, isn't it, for Jesus to illustrate his point. He's saying, look, imagine all the sheep and they're happily eating their grass and they see a wolf in the distance. Well, they're all going to take whatever. I don't know how sheep actually would defend themselves from wolves. I'm not a shepherd, but presumably there's slightly better chance if they can see that it's a wolf. Whereas if it's dressed up as a sheep, come and join us. Come into the flock. Make yourself at home. And Jesus said it will be like that in the Christian church. You'd have to listen carefully when you're wanting to work with someone, wanting to say, oh, we're all Christians together. You know, that is lovely and that is often true. And it's really encouraging when it is true. But you do just have to make sure, Jesus says, is this really about coming to God through Jesus and trusting in his death on the cross as the only way to be forgiven and right with him? So that's the first danger, the first obstacle or difficulty that they face as they go about God's work in Ezra 4. Opponents offer to help in verses 1 to 3. And then secondly, outsiders tend to discourage. And that is verses 4 to 7. Those who are not yet part of the Christian faith may not want to see it grow or progress. So chapter 4, verse 4. Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans. So they're discouraging. People are feeling afraid because they're a minority in this work. Officials are being bribed. Plans are being frustrated. And then the writer does something very strange, very unusual. The writer sort of breaks off the story of Ezra, chapters 1 to 4 and chapters 5 onwards. They're telling the story of Jerusalem, but the writer breaks away from that story, pauses from it, and takes us into the future and gives us something that won't happen until much later. And that's why you've got a series of different kings mentioned here. I'll put them up on the screen there. You've got King Cyrus, who's mentioned in chapter 4, verse 5. He was the king when they started building the temple. Then you've got Darius in the same verse, who was the king by the time they finished the temple. And then you've got Xerxes, who was the king a bit later, mentioned in verse 6. And Artaxerxes, who was another later king in verse 7. So we're talking a long period of time here. And the writer is saying, as you move through these different periods of time and periods of history and different generations, the same thing keeps on happening. Happened under Cyrus, happened under Darius, happened under Xerxes, happened under Artaxerxes. The same opposition from outsiders again and again. And that, I think, is the big point that he's making here, that this is not unusual. People outside the faith, not really liking aspects of it and not wanting to encourage it and trying to even sort of slow it down, that is normal throughout the Bible and normal throughout Christian history. In fact, Jesus told his followers to expect it. He said, look, what kind of reception did I get to my message? Well, I was persecuted and put to death. Jesus said to his followers, they hate me, they're going to hate you. If you stand for me and you stand with me, you've got to expect that at least as a first reaction, many of the people around you, well, they may be polite and they may be respectful and they may be doing what they think is best, but they're not going to be supportive of this work. They're going to prefer to see you a bit less involved. And they're going to want to see it slow down a little bit, at the very least. And the Bible is saying that is normal Christianity. We have to expect that. Outsiders then often discourage in verses 4 to 7. Opponents offer to help. Outsiders tend to discourage. And then thirdly, authorities learn to distrust in verses 8 to 22. It is very common for those in power to hear misinformation about God's work and to come to think that God's work is not really going to be in their interests. So chapter 4, verse 8, Rehum, the commanding officer, and Shimshai, the secretary, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes, the king, as follows. Now, these are two small local officials of minor importance, and they've got together, and they're writing a letter to the most powerful person in the whole of the ancient world at that time, to King Artaxerxes. Remember, this is long after the story of Ezra. Now, the Old Testament is, I don't know if you knew this, the Old Testament is written in Hebrew. That was the language that was spoken in Jerusalem. That was the home language for Jewish people. That's what it's written in. But these letters and these chapters of Ezra are written in Aramaic, which was the language of the Persian Empire at the time. And I think the Bible does that deliberately to get across this sense that what we're doing now is we're stepping away from God's people and we're overhearing a conversation in another language, in another culture, with big, powerful people over them. These people don't really understand the faith of God's people. It's a different culture. They don't even speak the same language. And they're not talking to God's people, they're talking about God's people. And when that happens, the Bible is saying it often goes a bit like this. Verse 11. Here's the letter that was sent. Verse 11. This is a copy of the letter they sent him. They sent to the king. To King Artaxerxes, from your servants, the men of Trans-Euphrates. The king should know that the people who came up to us from you have gone to Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They're restoring the walls and repairing the foundations. Furthermore, the king should know that if this city is built and its walls are restored, no more taxes or tribute or duty will be paid. Eventually, the royal revenues will suffer. Now, since we are under obligation to the palace, and it's not proper for us to see the king dishonored, we're sending this message to inform the king, so that a search may be made in the archives of your predecessors. In these records, you will find that this city is a rebellious city, troublesome to kings and provinces, a place with a long history of sedition. That's why this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is built and its walls are restored, you'll be left with nothing in Trans-Euphrates. You see what they're saying? Oh, great king of Persia, we just want to support you. There's no kind of self-interest in this at all. We're just being good, loyal, honest citizens. We know that it's not in your interests to let these people carry on with what they're doing. They're not going to pay their taxes. If they rebuild their walls, you won't be able to stop them. They're not going to be supportive. They're going to break away from you. You'll be left with nothing. Just look back in the history records and find out, and you'll see they've always been troublemakers. Now, in fact, the Old Testament prophets, just like the New Testament letters, teach believers to respect authority and to pay taxes and to pray for leaders and to obey laws and to do that even when those in authority may not be good leaders. They may not be good laws. Still, believers are told, be good citizens. And if you check back in the history of that time, he could have come across people like Daniel in the Bible, or Esther, or Jeremiah, who all lived that way and behaved that way and taught that way. But sadly, if you search long enough, you're always going to find bad examples as well. You're always going to find a few who disobey God and claim to belong to God, but actually give God a bad name. And that is what they find in the records, just before the Babylonian invasion. There were kings who ignored prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, and who did rise up in rebellion, and that is why Babylon invaded the city. And if you search hard enough, you're going to find examples of people doing bad things. And that's what happens. Chapter 4, verse 18. The letter you sent us, this is over the page 476, verse 18. The letter you sent us has been read and translated in my presence. I issued an order and a search was made, and it was found that this city has a long history of revolt against, against kings, and has been a place of rebellion and sedition. Jerusalem has had powerful kings ruling over the whole of Trans-Euphrates, and taxes, tribute, and duty were paid to them. Now issue an order to these men to stop work. Well, all too often, we hear, don't we, about student Christian groups who are told to stop meeting on a Christian campus. That happened at Anglia Ruskin University a few years ago. It happens when someone who doesn't agree with what the Christians are saying and who doesn't like it and is offended by it will decide to make a complaint to the authorities, and the authorities speak a different language, they don't know what it's about, they have no understanding of it, but they believe the bad reports that they hear. And there are parts of the world, some of us have lived in parts of the world where Christianity is not trusted, it's seen by the authorities as a threat, as a danger to law and order. Even here in the UK, which has a long history of being linked with Christianity, even here, not so long ago, there was a law going through Parliament, a draft law, and a lot of Christians objected to it because really the people campaigning for that law, they'd had very bad experiences personally of churches and of Christianity, and they come to see Christian counselling and youth work as hazardous and dangerous and harmful. And so their proposals were actually saying you've got to sign a consent form to say you know how harmful it will be to talk to many ordinary pastors and youth workers and Christian counsellors. Unfortunately, that didn't go through, but it came close. And tragically, when people say that about Christianity, there's often some truth in it. You can often find examples of someone somewhere who has done terrible things in the name of God, not because of their Christianity, but in spite of it. Not because they've got too much of Jesus, but because they've got too little of Jesus. But very often those ugly and horrible stories are the ones that get made into movies or reported on in documentaries and enter this popular idea until people say, well, I can't trust Christianity. And it should be some reassurance and some comfort to us that the Bible has been talking about this since hundreds of years before Jesus. There's nothing new in this. This is a normal response to God's work. So there we are, three obstacles they face and we face as well. Today, if we're wanting to see God work in our lives, in other people's lives, in our church, we have to expect some of these things to happen. Opponents offer to help, outsiders tend to discourage, authorities learn to distrust, stopping God's work. That's the tragic end of the chapter. It actually works in chapter 4, verse 23. As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary, and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. That's the end of the little story that we've been hearing about in the future. Remember, it's not part of the story of Ezra, but this is a kind of flash forward. And then the writer takes us back to the story that he's telling in the rest of Ezra, the thing that happened quite early in history. Takes us back to that story and says, well, that's what happened then as well. Verse 24, thus the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Not for a short time, for a long time. They'd been building the temple. They'd been celebrating last Sunday. And this Sunday they stop. Too discouraged, too afraid. Too many bribes and bad letters. And they stop for a whole decade, for 10 years, until they're able to start again. And I guess what God is saying to us today is, have we seen that these dangers are real for us? It is a wonderful thing if God is working in your life. Just the fact that you're here this morning, at least to me, I would say that's a sign that God is working in your life. For some of you, it may be just the beginning. Maybe that you're connecting again with Christian faith after a long time away, or just beginning to explore it. For others, we've been Christians for a long time. We see ourselves as part of the team, and we're fully on board. But either way, it's a wonderful thing when God is working in our lives, and we need to realize there are things that could stop it. And no one's going to stop God forever. No one's going to stop Jesus from returning. But in a particular place, or a particular church, or a particular person, it is possible, at least for a time, for God's work to go on hold. And we need to ask ourselves, what would it take for each of us? It's always important, isn't it, to see hazards coming. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. Are there things that have slowed down God's work in your life, that have put you into a sort of back seat, that have made you more of a spectator, watching what is happening rather than at the heart of it, involved and growing? There is nothing better than to meet God. We're going to see next Sunday how God's work can restart and how these obstacles are so often overcome. And I hope that'll be a slightly more encouraging sermon to preach than this one. But for now, I think God is saying to us, don't take it lightly. God's work is hugely important, and we can praise God for it. We can take great care to let nothing stop it.